welcome back to another edition of Sideline Sessions with Wesley Sykes. I am, of course, Wesley Sykes, the managing editor of Coach and Athletic Director, Training and Conditioning, and Winning Hoops Brands for Great American Media Services. And you can listen to all of our previous episodes anywhere you can access podcasts, as well as any of our websites. So that's coachad.com, training-conditioning.com, and winninghoops.com. And be sure to follow all of those brands on Twitter. So that's at coach_AD, at train condition, and at winning hoops. And just one more housekeeping note for those in the sports medicine profession looking to earn CEUs, training and conditioning, one of our offshoot sister brands, does offer opportunities to earn those CEUs through reading our digital editions of each issue and then taking part in a short quiz afterwards. So simply select the continuing education tab on training-conditioning.com and follow the connecting link to get started. But with that out of the way, we welcome to the program a few titans of the strength and conditioning industry. First, we have Chip Sigmund, owner of Sigmund Sports Performance and a strength coach at our former strength coach at UNC Chapel Hill, including the Charlotte Hornets, as well as Appalachian State. We have Jerry Palmieri, a former strength coach with 34 years of experience, 13 of which in college, 21 in the NFL, finishing his time with the New York Giants. And last but not least, we have Mike Gentry, who has 35 years of collegiate strength and conditioning experience, primarily at Virginia Tech, and is a USA Strength Coach Hall of Famer. So thank you all, gentlemen, for taking the time to join us here today.
Glad to be with you, Wayne.
All right, awesome. And we have you all here today because you all took part in a book here called The Golden Age of Strength and Conditioning, available anywhere where books are published, Amazon included there. And I think maybe with Chip, I think what I would love to know is tell us about this book a little bit, how it came about, and what your involvement from your perspective is.
Well, once again, Wes, we appreciate the opportunity. It's been out now for, I guess, 2 years, the book. And it started, and as I wrote in the introduction, I gave when it was a cold November, rainy Monday morning in November of 2017, I believe, I gave Mike Gentry a call and just to say hello, catch up how he was doing. He had just retired from Virginia Tech and just want to know how he was doing. And we started talking, and so one thing led to another. And I said, Mike, what did you make when you went to East Carolina? I think that was what, Mike, 84, 82?
82.
Yeah, 82. And Mike told me the ballpark number of what was that? What was the first year? What did you make?
$12,000.
Yeah, $12,000. And Mike then looked at me and then he said, what'd you make, Chip? I said, well, I went to Appalachian State in 84 for free, just room and board and training table to eat. And he says, well, Mike says, well, you got me beat. He says, I made, you know, what he just mentioned and the money. And so I said, well, you know, that was a great time. And I said, that was the golden age of strength and conditioning for sure. And Mike said, you know what? That sounds like a book. That's exactly how it came to be. And that's what I wrote. And they were kind enough to let me write the introduction. So I started thinking, driving to work. And I said, you know, that would be a good, the history of strength and conditioning. So I thought, of course, I need some help with this. And nobody knows more than these two guys, a former strength conditioning coaches. And so I knew Mike would be on the list. I gave my good friend who I was with at University of North Carolina with, Jerry Palmieri. We were both assistant strength coaches there from 82, 84, somewhere in there. And then I gave two more people, Alan Johnson. He was a strength coach at Ohio State at the time. And then I gave Bill Ferran a call, strength coach from Miami Heat. But he had been with Jimmy Johnson at the University of Miami Hurricanes when he won the national championship. So we had that was the core group. And so, and guys, butt in now. This is very informal, as you said, Wes. And mm-hmm. butt in, and he said, I knew I needed some help. So those guys, that was our core group of guys who led the way for this book to be published. And after 2 years of getting a publisher, the core media group, of selecting, the hard thing was selecting not only the title for the book, but also mainly the 32 coaches that we selected to be in this book. And that was the hardest thing. And then two exercise science professors to tell their story and how exercise science has progressed over the many, many years. Dr. Michael Stone and Travis Triplett, who was the first president of the NSCA. So after a two-year process, and I think it was 2019 of March, April, somewhere in there, it was published. And so it's something we're very proud of, something that kind of tells a story of what each person went through, each coach went through to getting where he is and or she, and made a pathway for the strength conditioning coaches in today's profession.
You know, and what I found amazing about the whole strength and conditioning industry as a whole is that, you know, from the people inside kind of doing the work, I hear nowadays it's kind of on that precipice as of film watching, as far as diagnosing film for football players, how it's kind of trickling down to the high school level more and more and spreading out more. It's not necessarily something used for just big level college programs or professional teams. It's something that's getting adopted more on the foundational level as well. And a lot of people tend to think that this industry is kind of, again, on this precipice of exploding if it hasn't already. But just how far has that come from your experiences? Again, maybe from those late early 80s days with maybe working with the James Worthy teams of UNC and whatnot. So maybe with Jerry, with yourself, you know, what did you bring to this book from your perspective, and how did you kind of bring that to life on the page?
Well, I think when you talk about the progression of the profession, and that's really what we're wanting to get across, because you look at strength and conditioning staffs now, you have a staff of five in the Power Five just for football.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, you know, you have a director over the so-called Olympic sports, and they may have six, seven, eight assistants. So you have these staffs of, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15 people, where in the old days there was a head strength and conditioning coach, and maybe you had an assistant, maybe it was a GA, as it was at North Carolina. It was a head strength and conditioning coach and then four part-time guys. That was it. And so it's evolved to greater recognition. And as you heard Chip and Mike discuss their salaries at the beginning of their career, it's evolved financially too. So it's given a great deal of respect. Everybody talks about, oh, the strength coach nowadays, he does more than just lifting and running. Well, hey, no kidding. We did that all our entire career. Just nobody ever noticed it. Nobody ever realized it. Nobody ever understood what we did. But we were doing that with a staff of, like I said, you know, two or three people.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mike, you know, I wonder, was it tougher to get people to buy into your philosophies at an earlier stage in that maybe that early 80s? I remember a conversation I believe Boyd Epley was having about trying to get his football team to not do distance running anymore in order to increase endurance and increase power and to kind of break that mold of that old thinking now. And I feel like does a strength conditioning coach have a bigger say in that room now as far as decision-making process, or am I out of line there?
No, I think we had a lot of say what happened in our room or what we did. Some coaches held on to the 12-minute run and things like that, but not, mm-hmm. not so many. And most of them didn't know much about training. You know, one thing about the early people in the career is it wasn't about money. I always felt if I made as much as a school teacher, I was okay at the beginning, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved to lift weights, as these guys did too. And Al Johnson and everybody that was in the business had a real love of training, and they brought that to the table. And usually the coaches didn't really, the sport coaches didn't know that much about it. So they were glad to give it to you. And Jerry, as he mentioned, oh my gosh, this is the bad part, the senior moments. But, you know, he mentioned that the staff sizes, but we coached everybody. We didn't just coach football. Right. So it was kind of incredible. But you did what you could with the facilities that you had and the time that you had. And you had a love of training. And we all approached it a little bit differently. But the kids bought in because they wanted to be better. And that's still true. And so the relationships will always be the most important part of it, I think.
Now, no, I jump in on that, Wes. I think please. That in those early days, because it was people didn't know a whole lot about strength training. It was easier to coach. Mm-hmm. Now, toward the end of my career, everybody's a strength coach now. Everybody right. know, you know, they read on the internet, they read this. So if you got this personal training guru who markets himself and he says something, or somebody comes back and says, hey, we should be doing this, we should be doing that. We, you know, I say, don't tell me what we should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. And so, yeah, I think we had to convince them that this is important because they weren't even involved in strength training. But like I think what Mike said, once they saw the results, they bought in.
Mm-hmm.
Because kids have been involved in strength training, you know, in high school and everything, and they're on the internet and they're looking, reading all these different magazines. And I'm not talking about bodybuilding or powerlifting, you know, just everything that
mm-hmm.
you go on the internet, there's always something new, something new doing. And the more different it is in the eyes of most of these young athletes, the better it is. Mm-hmm. You know, just grabbing, you know, barbells and weights and dumbbells isn't good enough anymore. They want whatever's different, because that's gonna give them the edge, so to speak. And it's just not true.
Well, I think you bring up a good point, because that was something I wanted to get to. Well, cause, you know, is there, you know, a analogy I like to use is a paralysis by analysis, right? And can you have too much information and knowledge and try to be too minute on details and focusing on things when, like you said, maybe dumbbells and squats and deadlifts and some of the simple things just kind of work?
Yeah, they're hard to market, but they work.
Right.
Yeah, that's it.
So I always wonder again, because like you said, marketing and kind of the fads and different types of workouts and everything. And like you said, there's a trainer for every niche market out there. And again, is it sometimes just lifting heavy things is going to get the results that you desire?
It is with beginners.
Yeah.
You know, for sure.
Most and back there, going back to the beginning of the book, as far as why we did it, we worked. The changes here, we worked with all sports.
Mm-hmm.
We worked, you know, I was the only guy my first year and worked with all sports. So you had to be really very knowledgeable in what each sports, the specificity of each sport, plus the basic movements. And there wasn't time to be fancy and things back there worked in the 80s, the squat, the bench press, the deadlift, and the cleans, the snatches, they still work today. Now you can center around all the stuff, fancy stuff you want to, but everything centers around that. And that's still the case today as it was in the 70s and 80s.
Can I add something there? You know, we were before the internet. There was no internet.
Mm-hmm.
There was no NSCA. There was no CSCS. There's no professional organizations. But most importantly, from what the average person knew or the lay person, there was no internet. And what happened was we became friends because we shared information with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it built a brotherhood where we weren't just competitors. We became friends. And we're still friends. And that's something that I think is missing a little bit today. Today, technology first.
Mm-hmm.
But through our love of training and trying different things and then interconnecting with other strength coaches and professionals doing similar things, we really shared a lot of greatness. And I don't mean that we were very smart or anything like that, but we cared so much mm-hmm. that we were willing to share it with each other. And that was pretty cool.
Please go ahead.
Well, I just think another thing is everything's become so technology based in training today. And, you know, we all have our philosophies. We're similar in our philosophies, the three men here on this call, but you know, we all differ. And I don't think it's so much the philosophy that made us good at what we did.
Mm-hmm.
It was how we coached the athletes, how we loved them, how we cared for them, how we trained them, how we got involved with them. You know, anybody can put a workout up on a board, but what are you going to do with that workout? How are you going to get the kids to perform it? How are you going to, you know, put your arm around a kid when you know, his girlfriend broke up from the night before, you know, or when they found out that their mom and dad are getting divorced and those kind of things. And you just cared for the kids. And we lived on the floor. That's where we were. You know, mm-hmm. It's hard to get each other on the phone during the workday, because that's where we were, you know, and we're working. So I think that's what made us successful at what we did, is because we got involved. Now, I'm not saying that current athletes, current coaches are not doing that. I'm not saying that at all. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we could talk about all the new innovations in our profession. But the bottom line is, you got to care for your athletes. You got to motivate them. You got to hold them accountable. You got to teach them, and you got to coach them. And that's the gist of the profession. And you do that, you're going to get results.
Also, Wes, there's 32 stories, and counting the exercise science professors, 34. But from those coaches, I was reading Mike Clark's this morning. Mm-hmm. Every story, Wesley, I think could be made into a movie, and especially with those two, but Johnny Parker, of how each coach cared about their athletes and how they came about. Mike Clark talks about how he found his wife, how some down times he had to talk, as Jerry was saying, had to talk his coach into, hey, coach, let's don't do distance running. Let's do some sprint work. Mm-hmm. And they went out to beat Syracuse. I believe it was Kansas, went out to beat Syracuse, and they just killed them. They gave the game ball to Mike Clark because they were in better shape. And that's just one story of 32, and how everybody started off with nothing and had to really work from, I went in the weight room, as these two guys did too, from in the morning when the sun was down. And you know what we got out of the weight room? Well, the sun was coming up. We got out of the weight room when the sun was going down. We never saw the light of day sometimes, except to go eat lunch, if that. So there's some interesting stories in this book of how from point A to where we are today. And it wasn't, if I may say this, it wasn't to, hey, we did this and we're jealous of what you're making now. No, we're glad that mm-hmm. these coaches are met. Now, these two other guys can tell you there's a ton of pressure out there now. A lot more. There was pressure when we were in it, of course, and the stress. But today's strength coach, if you have two losing seasons, and if the coach is gone, then basically you're gone.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you lost security and gained financially, but the security left. And as you became more specialized, you got hooked to that coach, and that coach is he recruited him. He's calling the plays. But you're married to that coach, and so if he gets fired, you're in the Power Five. You're going to probably lose your job too. So we lost a lot of security, I guess you'd say.
Mm-hmm. I can certainly see that, and I would love to circle back to a point of just what you guys were touching on before about being there from an emotional standpoint, creating that sort of relationship based. With their student athletes there in that case. And you hear this, you know, working in sports, media, you hear cliches all the time. So I would often hear that the strength coach is the backbone, maybe the unspoken backbone of the program. And it sounds like you're there with them all the time on a regular basis, you know, whether it's in the weight room or a lot. As someone who's not there on the inside, is that the case? Or would you say you spend more time as a strength coach with the players than maybe a positional or sport coach?
Well, I think we certainly did back in the day when we were coaching. You know, they put more restrictions on how much time you can spend with them mm-hmm. Nowadays. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we spend more time with all the athletes on the team. So if you look at a football team, we know everyone. We know everyone very well. But it's amazing how many defensive coaches have no idea about who some of the offensive players are, especially guys that are down the line. Mm-hmm. You know, backup players, and they just don't have any kind of connection because they don't work with them. We work with everybody. And, you know, you talk about relationships, Wes. One of my peers once said, you know, the weight room's like the barbershop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk about everything. And not to say that we spend time talking, we spend time working, but there's always those times before workouts, in between sets, whatever. Or when you got a guy coming in And where do they come? They come in, your office, and they sit down. They say, "Coach, you got a minute?"
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beauty of coaching, and that was the fun of coaching, pouring into the lives of these young people and stepping into their lives and helping them to grow, you know, not only the men we coach, but the women we coach.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much joy when you run into somebody, say, "Hey, you remember this girl? She was on a tennis team." And I said, "Oh, yeah, back at Kansas State." She couldn't stop talking about you, the impact you had on her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and did I make her a better tennis player? Yeah, it probably helped her a little bit. But you poured into her life, and that's what they remembered, the impact you had on their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we wanted to make them bigger, stronger, faster, help them improve in their sport. That was our job. But I think our calling is pouring into their lives and helping them to be, you know, grow to be fine men, fine women.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, somebody mentioned Johnny Parker, and he's been a mentor, and he is a true icon in my eyes. He's been a mentor for many of us. And his line is, "Coach the kid, not the weight."
Mm-hmm.
Bingo. Best. I've stolen it and used it so many times because that's what we're saying. If you can coach people, you will make an impact. And if you make an impact, you've changed things. You've changed, and it trickles away from you. So we were paid well, really.
Mm-hmm.
We just weren't paid well financially.
down the years, Wes, now, even now, we get cards and letters, emails, texts, mm-hmm. from former student athletes, from professional athletes.
Mm-hmm.
"Hey, coach, I love you." Now, sometimes I tell everybody this, we worked them hard. I know those two guys did. And a lot of times when I meet old players, former players, I don't know if they're going to hit me or hug me. but here's the deal. We wanted them to succeed in life.
Yeah.
And if you can succeed through the program we put you through, life is going to be easy. Now, we know that's not true. We know how hard life is. But we wanted them to, hey, making it through adversity is what life is all about. And I think we may maybe contributed a small part of that.
I think we were surrogate dads,
sure,
to a lot of them, because they didn't have a dad at home.
Mm-hmm.
And especially today's athlete.
Yeah. Yes. And I've had that kind of feedback, and it's very humbling. And to scaffold on what you said, Chip, some of your hardest heads, I know this is true for all of us, that you kind of battle. You see us battling, trying to get them to come along. They'll come back years later and say, "You were the only one that held me accountable. You were the mm-hmm. only one that held the line," you know, and they appreciated it.
You never remember the easiest teachers you have in school, right? It's always the ones who are the hardest and push it on you too. And I guess from the other end of that, right? It's I forget which coach said this, but I've heard this quote somewhere. But it's like, don't be alarmed when I'm getting on you as an athlete, but be alarmed when I stop. You know, mm-hmm. and that's when I stop caring or don't think you have it anymore, that I'm not going to necessarily ask it from you anymore. Right. Is that I forget. I wish I could remember the coach that said that. But I think that kind of speaks to exactly what you were saying. Right. It's the hard coaches that stay on you that actually want to get the most out of you because they believe in you.
Right.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But now, if we could switch gears a little bit to, again, some of the philosophies and the principles. I know you had said, you know, you coach the player and not the weight, or coach the athlete and not the weight there. But, you know, maybe from a football perspective, or the sport that you were, you know, most related to, you know, what did you find in success early on, in kind of developing a philosophy that worked for you? Because Mike, I know you, like you said, this was before the internet, before an actual free wave of information flowing back and forth between one another. You know, how did you necessarily find out what worked for you and your athletes?
If you're talking to me, I just felt that if an athlete got stronger, that was the foundation, just getting stronger. We're not even talking about speed, strength, or power,
mm-hmm.
that he was going to get better or she was going to get better in every facet of training or every facet of competition. They were going to get faster. They were going to jump higher. They were going to be able to move people better. So the foundation for me was just those basic core strength movements as far as the training aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you get your foundation, you can add to it with a lot of modalities and different things.
Mm-hmm. Maybe Jerry, from your perspective.
Well, the thing that we believed in was basically your big three movements: your clean for your pulling movement, your squat for your lower body strengthening, and your pressing for your upper body strength. And then we worked around those, but those were the core ones that we stuck to. And it was amazing, though, that as I advanced my career, I got a lot more involved in speed development and change direction and really teaching those mechanics of movement, which are very valuable. But I go back to the Oklahoma State days in the mid-80s, we lifted weights and we went out and we ran. And it was amazing. Guys were getting faster. Mm-hmm. There was not a whole lot of technique work done, but they got stronger and they ran and they got better. So, we did those core movements. We did plyometrics, we did jumping, but I don't think it's very fancy. The work, what I did in my room, what Chip did in his room, what Mike did in his room, were very similar. And as Mike said, because we all talked to each other, we mm-hmm. all communicated. And yeah, there was the National Strength and Conditioning Association had the magazines and those kind of things. We'd read that, but and then we go to the conference, and we'd listen to the speakers, but we'd spend a lot of time talking to each other. And I always felt if I came back to that conference learning one or two new things and someone helped me to try to put it all together, that was a win. And, mm-hmm. and that's how we kind of advanced our programs.
Amen.
Now, again, so how often would you guys, before the NSCA, how often would you guys get together at end of the season when maybe opposing teams play each other, visit each other in town for that sort of thing? Or how did you guys kind of come about?
That's a good question. I'm sure everybody's got a different answer. It used to be such that when we weren't adversaries as much, we were very competitive. Everybody had to be. You wouldn't mm-hmm. survive if you weren't. But the weekend of a game, they'd come in on Friday if they were coming to you, and you would typically a lot of times get together with that strength coach and whatever, go out to eat, go out and have a cup of coffee, have a beer, whatever, and talk and generally talk training. And I was talking about that actually to my wife today, how Brad Roll, came and we just sat down with legal pads and just, I couldn't write fast enough to get the information that he had gotten over at in the Soviet Union, and he had taken a trip over there, and those are good things. I think that's how we did. That's how I did it. That was one way.
Mm-hmm. Even in the NBA, when a player coach would, team would come across, Milwaukee Bucks come down to play in Charlotte, I would get together with a strength coach, with Bill Ferran with the Miami Heat, get together. It was a fraternity. Jerry can tell you this, in the NFL, there's only so many NFL teams, so many NFL strength coaches. So it was the same way in the NBA. And people really talk. We talk on the phone. I don't know if it's as prevalent today as it was back then, because there's so much competition. Some coaches even don't want you sharing information, and can understand that. But back then, it was like a fraternity. We were very, very, close to each other.
And does it change? Mike, I want to go back to a comment that you said earlier when you said, it's the basics are good for beginners, right? But when you're training the top of the top athletes, you want the specifics are what you need here. But when you go from collegiate athletes, professional athletes, just how different of that is, does your training go as far as, getting them that much better? Does your approach change at all?
Well, I think these two guys would answer that better. I never really wanted to go pro, and I never really had the opportunity to go pro either. But the basics, what I say is everything works, but not for long. Mm-hmm. So you've got to be in a constant stage of evolvement and change and periodization. And, so everything can work, and the most basic things can work with the raw beginner. You can move rocks in a wheelbarrow. As long as you keep adding rocks, things are going to get better, mm-hmm. And that's where then you still have to maintain, I believe, some of those basic things throughout your career. Jerry could, and Chip can talk to this better than I, but you add things to it and you try to be safer because the athlete's already probably strong enough, I assume, when they get to be a professional, most of them. I don't know that for true, but you got to maintain it. Please ask them that question.
Well,
I think that, you know, I did a lot of the same things in the NFL that I did in college.
That
was my philosophy. That's, you know, moving weight was important. And I think the key thing in the NFL was variety and changing things up, which you had an opportunity to do because you were working with less, you know, fewer athletes who lost Chip. I think the key thing when you get to the older athlete is being able to administer your philosophy in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, hey, we believe in squatting, but you know, someone may have a back history. He went through all college, he went through high school, he's a veteran in the NFL. His back might be trashed up. So, hey, you put him on a belt squat. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you're doing, you know, you're doing some dumbbell, heavy dumbbell work for lunges or for step ups that you can put a bar on his back. Or if someone's shoulders all jacked up, so instead of doing a bar bench, they're doing dumbbell bench. So you maintain your philosophy, you're still doing the things that you believe in, but you have to be flexible to understand that this athlete can't do that anymore. It doesn't work for him because of, you know, the changes in his body.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I really think that's a key to being successful when dealing with professional athletes. And yeah, you know, for variation is critical because you have them for, you know, a longer period of time with no change going on. You know, their off season is a long period from time they finish playing the last game to the time they start training camp. At least it was, you know, and then, you know, now they've cut that back where sometimes you see them for, you got an off season program for 2 weeks and then they were already doing stuff on the field with their coaches and they're into OTAs and then they're gone and then they're back. I mean, it's really kind of messed up, to be honest with you. But that's my point though. I think you have to get your philosophy, decide what you want to do, and then how can you continue with your philosophy and working around the limitations that athletes have. If you put a workout on the board and say, that's the workout, well, coach, what else can I do besides bench? If you can't do it, then just move on to the next exercise. Well, then you're failing to coach the athlete and help them get better.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, and I think that's, again, that kind of goes back to that relationship and coaching the athlete and not the weight, right? Again, so I think that's a great point. And it's something I think you brought up here or kind of got my mind running as you were saying it was, you know, having a previous injury history for a player, and, you know, whether that's coming from a college or a previous team or transfer or you know, how free-flowing of that information was available to you or would that take that kind of conversation between yourself and the student athlete or the athlete in general?
Well, you really relied on the sports medicine staff because they did all the research when they brought them in. And then anytime something goes down on an athlete or athlete develops something, there's got to be a free flow of communication between the strength coach and the sports medicine staff. And when there's a breakdown there, that's where you're going to have problems. When they're not telling you that this athlete has these limitations and, you know, you're pushing them and the athlete doesn't want to look like he's weak and make excuses. So you push him to do something, all of a sudden something breaks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happens? There's a breakdown in communication with the sports medicine staff. So, you know, and I'm not saying the sports medicine staff will fault all the time. Sometimes there are bonehead strength coaches in my profession that don't want to talk to the athletic trainer. They think they're all soft. Well, you know, there has to be a good balance between pushing guys and understanding what the limitations are. And because the athletes are going to work hard, but you don't want them working hard and getting diminishing returns because they're getting injured because of the limitations that they have.
Or perhaps sending a mixed messaging from the athletic training staff or the strength staff or whatever, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, guys, I think we're reaching up our time here. I do want to be cognizant of our time. We are in the holiday season here, so I do appreciate you taking the time out here today. But before we let you go, I would love to give you an opportunity to plug anything that you have going on, as well as the book, of course, The Golden Age of Strength and Conditioning, available anywhere books are sold, including Amazon here. But perhaps Chip, with yourself, and anything you, where can the people get in touch with you if they like?
Yeah, the core Media Group is the website.com. The mm-hmm. Core Media Group is our publisher, Robert Walker. If you type that in and hit golden, you'll get the shipping is free until December 31st on the book. So shipping is free. But something that each strength conditioning coach want to be, or knowing the history of the profession is so important.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jerry, where can the people get in touch with them if you'd like them to?
Sure. My email is my name, Jerry with a J, Palmieri, 910@gmail.com. I do a variety of speaking. I do a lot of spiritual presentations, sharing my faith as a Christian and challenging others. And I do a pretty good presentation on life lessons learned from coaching. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I get an opportunity to speak to some groups along those lines. So yeah, right now I'm retired. I'm enjoying life, busy. I do some three-dimensional coaching workshops. I got my hands in a lot of different fires, very active with Fellowship Christian Athletes. But life is good. I'm blessed, and I thank God for it.
Awesome. Fantastic. Thank you. And Mike, last but not least.
Oh, yeah. I am Coach Mike Gentry at gmail.com. Happy to interact with people. Have a book out from way back. I think it's still out. But I want to pub the NSCA and mm-hmm. say that it was a great thing that organization was developed, and it brought a lot of professionalism to our profession. We became more professional, and I've been certified since 1986 because I'm afraid I might fail the test if I didn't take it, if I had to take it again. So it's a good thing, and I encourage anybody that thinks they want to be a strength coach to look into it. And the educational process is just fantastic. They very, very much support the strength coach.
Awesome. Couldn't agree more. I'm sorry.
If I may say, thank you for doing this for us and for the strength conditioning profession. Training Conditioning Magazine, gosh, I did my first article for you guys late 90s, early 2000s, and have done many. I just got through doing one maybe 2 years ago, but thank you for Training Conditioning, what you guys do also. And I think you can tell we're all three of us have been very, very blessed, very fortunate that we grew up in the golden age of strength conditioning.
Amen.
Absolutely. And I wish we had more time. I would love to have you guys each on individually, and we'll go a little bit more into your backstory and everything. So I thought that would be great. But again, very appreciative of the time that we have here today. So the book is The Golden Age of Strength and Conditioning. So look for this episode to be out this week here, depending on when you're listening, December 16th. And to get a tune into who our next guest will be, follow our brands on Twitter. So that's @coach_AD. At Train Condition, at Winning Hoops, and then myself, if you like, that's @Wesley_Sykes_. Until then, sports fans, I am Wesley Sykes, and thank you for listening to another edition of Sideline Sessions, and thank you, fellas.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wes.
Thanks for the opportunity.